Having concluded Chapter 3 on Governance of UN Habitat, we're now going to start Chapter 4 on Leadership and Management. Firstly, I'd like to ask you something that has been cropping up in the media recently with a lot of criticism of the Secretary-General and other UN leaders. Are these criticisms, in your opinion, fair and justified? Is there a reason why the UN can't be managed, as some have suggested, as an enterprise?
In fact, you are perfectly right. I remember a journalist who said recently that the UN is a refuge for obscure politicians and retired diplomats. This might be quite true for political appointees. These are people who are at Secretary General, Under Secretary General, and Assistant Secretary General, people who are appointed without real competition. Ambassadors, many ambassadors are UN managers, UN executive heads, for instance in UNESCO, but in many other places, career diplomats, as well as politicians. In my view, these options are generally bad because ambassadors, politicians have very rarely managerial culture or managerial experience. This is why it usually doesn't work very well. Of course, they speak well. They make good statements, but in terms of administration, they are relatively poor. Most of the time, of course, there are exceptions. I think these systems should change, and the managers of the UN should be really selected on the basis of their qualification. But on the other hand, there is a kind of conspiration of silence among member states, because everybody hoped to become a member of the Secretariat, hope to become a leader of the Secretariat, and therefore everybody will congratulate the new executive head, the new Under Secretary General, unanimously, because the next one might be from your country. Therefore, UN reforms usually don't go very far. And I think this problem of leadership is probably one of the major weaknesses of the UN system. It's not the staff, it's not the rules or regulation, it is the way the leaders are selected. In fact, if you could take maybe all the political appointees in the UN, which may be 100 people approximately, and special envoys and all kinds of position, if you submit this small group to a serious test, competence test, I think you will be surprised. Some leaders are not even able to write their own speeches or to write their own text. They need an army of speech writers and an army of writers to work for them. And what is even worse, sometimes they don't even know the topic or the subject that they are supposed to address. The field is unknown when they start. They are just ambassadors, politicians, and therefore they have to learn. It takes them 2-3 years to learn what they are talking about. This may be, in fact, the majority of the leaders. Sometimes they are also excellent examples, so I should not be too negative, but I think this is the major problem. Why do the big power keep this system on? I think it's a way to keep the UN system down. It's a way to keep this system with a very low profile, and to allow the various Ministry of Foreign Affairs to exchange advantage in the UN machinery. I think this conspiracy is terrible. The UN is not an expanded foreign service. It is a much more complex machinery, and I think it must be value-driven. It is not just a way to negotiate the future of the planet. It is a way to take action, and particularly in the field of human development. So there is a lot to do, but the reform is still to come.
Well, what's your opinion then about the managerial culture of the UN? I recall that you said there were a lot of controls in the way the UN was managed as opposed to action. I wonder if you could elaborate on that.
I think if you want to, again, to describe the worst-case scenario, I think the management style in the UN at the highest level often combines the three isms. The first ism is what I call despotism. A despotism means only the boss decides on everything. There is no discussion, there is a top-down decision-making process, And this happens in many UN bodies. The second ism is a nepotism. And this one is even worse. It means that the boss, the executive head, recruits mostly his friends, his supporters, his cronies, those who are going to be very obedient and very supportive, independently of their qualification. And the third ism is clientelism. Clientelism means the boss prioritizes his clients, that is, the beneficiaries of the agency activities will be such and such countries, such and such region or institutions, and in exchange they will provide their political support, particularly for the reappointment of the boss. We have seen many examples like that in many UN organizations. In fact, what is amazing is that the systems, in fact, fully allow this management style, this three-ism. There is no real control over that. And we have plenty of audits, plenty of investigation, and we have even an ethic office, but all these mechanisms never address these issues, deep issues of management. Therefore, many staff members have to go to the UN dispute tribunal to challenge the decision in terms of recruitment and to try to get compensation because they are not selected while they are fully competent, and incompetent managers are selected instead. That's also an explanation of the widespread sycophancy. Sycophancy means, in simple term, bootlicking. So there is a lot of bootlicking to get promotion, and therefore, even the staff union, in fact, the staff union is the first sycophant in the UN. The staff union is very supportive of every leader to get, again, to get appointment, to get promotion. So that's also what you see in governing bodies, in the Committee of Permanent Representatives, for instance, a lot of congratulations to the executive director because many diplomats hope to be recruited by the UN Secretariat. So hypocrisy is also a UN value. Unfortunately, I learned that from the beginning. And the final bad dimension of this culture is secrecy. That is, many decisions are taken behind closed doors without participation. And as a result, there is a lot of rumors and gossips. I think there is a lot to change in the UN culture, but to change all this aspect requires not only good leadership, but also full participation of the staff and full support from member states. So that's quite a challenge for future UN leader and particularly for the Secretary General.
Well, given that rather negative point of view, what would be the qualifications that you would see in an ideal leader? Because surely such a thing must exist.
Yeah, there are many good leaders, fortunately, in the UN. I'm just trying to correct what has to be corrected. I'm not at all a sycophant, so I'm just trying to focus on what has to be improved. In fact, last year I tried to define with some colleagues what would be the ideal manager, that is, the ideal executive director or the ideal deputy executive director. We had a lot of brainstorming, and we agree on a number of qualities, of competencies. First, we said this leader, this ideal manager, should have at least a basic knowledge of our field. In our case, urbanization, housing, and the same applies to other agencies, at least a basic knowledge. Number two, the leader should be committed to zero nepotism. I don't know if this is really possible or if it is a dream, but zero nepotism will be a must, particularly for staff motivation. And a control mechanism should probably be established, much better than the current control mechanism, which is largely a joke. Number three, I think a good manager should be completely open to internal and external discussion, internal with his colleagues, with his peers, his managers, and external discussion with member states. Many managers consider that they are the chief executive officer of the UN, while they are not. They are subject to the will and to the decision of a member state. So they should be able to discuss. Number four, something which is a recurrent issue in the UN system, a leader should be able to fix the administration. Administration of the UN, which is quite heavy and bureaucratic, this has to be addressed in every agency, and you have to be accountable, financially accountable. With all the power that you have to report, you have to accept to be accountable. Number five, you need to have a vision on what you want the UN to do. The UN cannot do everything under the sky, so you have a focus and a vision. And finally, you have to be open to international activities. You have to have an international experience, a culture of diversity, a culture of dialogue. It seems that we are looking for something which is very difficult to combine. I think if member states support the recruitment system of the UN objectively, this is possible. The leader should also, I forgot that, should have also some charisma, should be really a leader bringing people along within the secretariat and also in the partners outside the secretariat. I think this is a kind of definition of a world-class hero, difficult, of course, to bring to Nairobi, which is not the most attractive city in the world, but with the appointment of our new executive director, John Close, many of us have a lot of expectation, enormous hopes, and we think that we are not far of that job description, which is maybe overambitious.
Thank you. Now I wish to know your views on the worst practices of UN Habitat.
Oh, yes, that's difficult. Yeah, because in fact this chapter is about the most difficult side of the UN. And maybe this question will be deleted in the final CD-ROM, I don't know. Let's see. But I think if I had to, I already said that. I would say non-excellence in management is by far the major weakness or the worst practice of the UN. And this includes, as I already said, excessive nepotism, but also relatively low productivity, ineffective bureaucracy, and particularly in terms of human resource management. In fact, in Habitat, we have gone down since 2005, 2006 in terms of bureaucratic control. We have increased the control. We have created a kind of monster, which is called the Program Support Division, which is trying to control everything that the substantive officers are trying to do. So this is what I call non-excellence in management that Habitat is supposed to fix through its medium-term strategic and institutional plan. That's a real challenge. An aspect which is related to that is the fact that we have a lot of control. A lot of control, more control than action. Normally, I believe that any administration should devote its effort to support the work of substantive officers and less effort to the control of their work. That is 80% support, I would say, and 20% control. In Habitat, we started a bit like that when I created this PSD in the late 90s. Initially, it was like 60% support and 33% control. But progressively, we moved to 80% control and less than 20% support. This is the current situation in the year 2011 in Habitat. And in addition, we have an excessive staffing of the controllers. The executive director office plus the program support division represent at least one quarter of the staffing table of the Habitat headquarters, which is, of course, a demonstration of top heaviness and a real calamity, and against all advice from New York that the UN system should be very efficient and should devote its resources to concrete activities rather than to bureaucratic control. We tried to address that issue, in fact, when we had the revitalization of Habitat, but it came back. We created even UNON in 1996 to combine the administration of UNEP and Habitat, and then progressively Habitat recreated its internal administration with PSD, which largely duplicates the work of UNON, of the Division of Administration. And again, with the medium-term strategic and institutional plan, instead of improving management, we recruit consultants, more and more consultants, and we don't address the real issues. For instance, that we need 1 year to recruit any expert, while it should be done in 1 month. So this is something which for experts like myself and many colleagues is absolutely unacceptable. On the substantive side, I have only one comment, that we should try and avoid unnecessary blah blah, unnecessary statement which just confirm what everybody knows, particularly on topics that we don't really master, like housing finance or municipal finance. We should speak only when we have something to say.
All right, but don't you believe that that excessive control and top-heaviness, aren't these things quite characteristic of the UN, a typical UN device that just will be there?
Yeah, I don't think so. I think there was a big trauma in recent years, and this was when we closed the oil for food program in Iraq. As you remember, Iraq, under Saddam Hussein, Iraq was selling its oil, and all revenue were going to the UN, at least in part, to support poverty alleviation in Iraq. And this was the famous oil for food program. After the invasion of Iraq in 2003 by the American and the British armies, there was a lot of pressure in the American media to carry out an investigation on the oil for food program. And this was done by a commission called Volcker Commission in the year 2004. The American media were expecting a lot of this investigation to demonstrate that the UN was corrupt, was inefficient, etc., etc. This investigation was created a real paranoia in the UN leadership. In fact, I would say all Undersecretary General or Executive Director whose agencies have been involved in Iraq became completely paranoid. In fact, we had investigation even at night. We had hard disk openings. We had it was like in a movie. And finally, this investigation, which costed, if I remember correctly, $23 million, discovered a total diversion of money of $150,000, which is ridiculous. So the ratio between the cost of the diversion, because between the diversion and the cost of the investigation was 1 to 150. So it was, of course, ridiculous. In fact, it demonstrated that the UN was working quite well and was very honest. But of course, the result of this useless investigation was not published in the American media, unfortunately. But anyway, during that period, 2003-2004, particularly in Habitat, because Habitat had a huge program under Oil for Food in the year 97 to 2003, this created a terrible paranoia. And as a result, we were invited to increase tremendously our control mechanism and our audit mechanism. The delegation of authority disappeared, etc., etc. What I can say is that I have been 17 years director of a division, the division which had the highest budget of Habitat. We implemented more than $2 billion of projects all over the world. We had many audits, internal audits, external audits, etc., etc. The only thing which was found by these many audits were a few minor mistakes, but never any diversion of funds, never any problem of accountability. So all my colleagues in that division said, "Why don't you let us work? Please, you are welcome to control, but control post facto. Let us work, and then show us if we are not performing, if we are diverting the money." This is not the case. Bureaucracy is a weed. Bureaucracy has to be eradicated in the UN. And to do so, you need a real political will. Because many leaders prefer that we don't work and we don't make mistakes. It is less dangerous, but of course, this is not why we are paid.
On a different note, were you happy with the fundraising during your time at the UN?
No, I'm really not happy. In fact, the UN, and that's another bad side of the UN, I have to conclude on the bad side of the UN and move to better side, but the bad side of the UN is that the top managers spend their time in begging all over the world, begging to bilateral, begging to multilateral, trying to find resources because the UN is underfunded. So it's not only humiliating to spend your life begging, but it's also, of course, a waste of energy. And of course, it also implies that you lose your focus, you become donor-driven. You try to follow the priorities of every donor and therefore not to respond to the real needs of the developing world. Recently, Habitat has created the so-called Resource Mobilization Unit, which in my view is a complete waste of resources because this unit is not mobilizing anything, just creating a database. And donors, in fact, have their own priorities. This is to be accepted. But we should reduce donor dependency. We should avoid as much as possible supply-driven programs. In my division, we have made good progress because we have mobilized funds from the developing world itself and from economies in transition. So we have reduced our dependency vis-à-vis the donor community, which remains, of course, particularly for humanitarian activities and post-disaster activities. But generally speaking, the main issue here is that the UN is underfunded, and this has to be addressed if you want to strengthen the UN.
Well, thank you very much. You've raised a lot of very interesting issues and given us a lot of food for thought. Of course, this is probably one of the most critical chapters of this collection, but we hope that we will have some chance for a bit more optimism in the next chapter, chapter 5, which is on staffing. Thank you.